طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. There has been a process underway involving both Israelis and Palestinians to frame a plan to move forward to achieve one democratic secular state in Palestine, Israel, which guarantees equal rights to all of its people, regardless of race, ethnicity, or religion, who live between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. One of those involved in this effort is Jeff Halper, who is an American-born anthropologist, author, lecturer, and political activist, who was born and raised in Minnesota, but has lived in Israel for the past 38 years. He is co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and author of Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine. This week, we feature Jeff Halper in conversation with Professor Leila Farsak of UMass Boston on a webinar moderated by Michael Spath of the Indiana Center for Peace in the Middle East. We begin with introductions.
We're delighted today to dig deeper into the One Democratic State campaign with our two guests, Dr. Leila Farsak, chair of the Department of Political Science at University of Massachusetts, Boston. Leila has written extensively on issues related to the Palestinian economy. Her latest book, which she has co-edited, is The Arab and Jewish Questions, Geographies of Engagement in Palestine and Beyond. And Jeff Halper, founder of Israel Committee Against House Demolitions, his two books, War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, and his latest, Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine, Zionism, Settler Colonialism, and the Case for One Democratic State, have been received with great acclaim. So Leila and Jeff, welcome. We all know, I see some applause. Yes, welcome to you all. We all know that the intentional long-range policies of Israel have made a two-state solution untenable, that it's really been moribund for a long time now, if it ever really was even a possibility given Zionism's goals. We're hearing about the various alternatives to two states, one state, confederation, and various iterations of each one. I'd like to start by asking each one of you to give a short, no longer than 5-minute opening statement why at this moment the one democratic state you're proposing is the best alternative. Jeff?
Well, thanks, Michael, for organizing this in the Middle East Center and the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace. And thanks, Leila, for agreeing to join me. And thank you all for joining. You know, I'm a part of the One Democratic State campaign, which is a Palestinian-led initiative to begin to replace the one apartheid state that already exists between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River with a democratic state of equal rights for all its citizens. But it's not only another kind of a solution to throw into the mix, but there's a very strong political logic behind this idea. And it comes out from kind of a new analysis. It's that Zionism is that we're not in a conflict. A conflict is a certain kind of situation where you two sides or more disagree about something or fight about something. And then the way you resolve a conflict is they come together, they negotiate, they find compromises, and then you get to some kind of a resolution. But Zionism is a form of settler colonialism. Settler colonialism is an idea that is not new in the academic world. There's a journal of settler colonialism. There's been hundreds of articles about settler colonialism. Layla has written about settler colonialism like many other people. But the concept of settler colonialism has not really penetrated into the wider public discourse about Palestine. And I can understand why. You know, if you take terms like conflict or occupation or apartheid, they're easy for people to understand. They're common terms. A term like settler colonialism, what? I mean, colonialism, you know, the British and India, okay, I get that. But settler, even though the United States is a settler colonial country, it's not a term we're used to using. It's an academic term. It doesn't flow easily. And what it leads to is a kind of resolution, which is decolonization. The only way you resolve a colonial situation is through decolonization. Well, what is that? I mean, that's also a term that's completely foreign and very complex for people to get their minds around. So that I think part of our job, maybe the first part of our job, is to try to find that language to help people understand what kind of a conflict, if you want to use that term, we're in. Because what your analysis is determines the logic of what's going on and the conclusion you come to. So that if you see this as a conflict, then you adopt a conflict resolution model. And that's what we've had for the last 70 years. And the reason it hasn't worked is you're trying to use a screwdriver to hammer in a nail. You have a problem. You got to get the nail in the wall, but you're using the wrong tool. I think the fact that we've taken the idea of settler colonialism and tried to lay out what that means, means that then we have to decolonize. And what we're trying to do in our movement, the ODSC campaign, is to really lay out what does decolonization mean. And we have a 10-point plan that I think, Michael, you're going to talk about a little bit. But basically then, that's really why I think our campaign is not only presenting a new kind of way out, but that has a very strong political logic behind it. You know, the two-state solution that everybody has been talking about not only is dead, but it never was. And again, settler colonialism explains why it never was. Because settler colonialism is a unilateral thing. It's not two sides. It's unilateral. It's when a population comes to a country with the intent of taking it over. So Zionism didn't intend to take over 78% of Palestine and leave 22% for the Palestinians. The Palestinians' indigenous population weren't even a consideration. They weren't a side. Zionism never recognized the Palestinians. To this day, Israel does not recognize not only the existence, but the national rights of the Palestinian people. And it certainly doesn't recognize their claim over the country or over territory. So the entire thrust of a settler colonial movement is to take over a country. The term Zionism used, the term that Israel uses, is Judaization. We're Judaizing Palestine. We're transforming an Arab country into a Jewish country. And all of it, not 78% or 90%, the whole thing. So that if you understand that, then you begin to understand not only why negotiations never succeeded, because it was never good faith. Because a colonial movement is not going to really negotiate with the indigenous population in good faith to give up land that it covets, that it has the power to take. Why would it do that? And so that the two-state solution never was. And we see it today very clearly with settlements and talk of annexation, an actual annexation of East Jerusalem and so on. So the two-state solution, we have to just forget. It never was. There never was a two-state solution.
So we'll get in. And so Jeff, we'll get
one more sentence, and that is the other. You know, a variation of the two-state is the idea of confederation, and you know, like Sam Bahour writes about, and other people. You know, I'm not really opposed to confederation. As a matter of fact, as a member of the Israeli peace movement, I supported the two-state solution for many years. It wasn't that we didn't accept that idea, especially if Arafat did, or the idea of confederation. The point is that we understand today that Zionism, the state of Israel, impelled by a settler colonial ideology and structure, will not allow any kind of, whether it's a state or a federal peace, of Palestinians to have any kind of equality, any kind of control over its own destiny, or over, certainly over territory. And so the only solution that remains, so it doesn't only make sense politically, but it makes sense in terms of the way that the struggle has been defined by Israel and by Zionism, really. The only way out is decolonization. And the only form of decolonization that can work is the creation of a single state, inclusive of everyone, with equal rights for everyone, and, of course, the return of refugees.
Thank you, Jeff. We'll dig deep into some of those points that you raised. Leila, please.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you very much, Jeff, for your words. I totally agree with you, and I actually thank you very much for emphasizing the issue of colonialism and decolonization, because I think, you know, we Palestinians have always said that Zionism is a colonial project. I think the trajectory over the past 70 years has been for us to also see that it is also a national project. But fundamentally, it's a national project that is colonial in its essence and in its means. But it is true that with the Oslo peace process, there has been an attempt to forget all this colonial and settler colonialism and pretend that we can have a two-state solution. But as Jeff rightly pointed out, the two-state solution was never meant to be a two-state solution. Israel was never interested in a two-state solution. Israel, with the Oslo peace process, was interested in finding a way by which Palestinians can govern themselves under Israeli sovereignty, or at least under Israeli supervision. And if we look at what has happened in 20 years of peace process, that's exactly nearly 30 years of peace process. That's exactly where we are today. Today we are in a reality in which Israel is sovereign from the river to the sea. Israel is the only sovereign entity that has four different legal regimes under its control. One legal regime in which for the Jews, in which Jews are equal citizens, having rights and privileges. One for Palestinian citizens of Israel, in which they are Israeli citizens and have political rights and economic rights, but are treated as second-class citizens. And this was particularly confirmed with Israel's nationality law in 2008 that affirmed the right of self-determination only to the Jewish people. And then Israel has another legal system for the Palestinians living in East Jerusalem. These are residents that do not have voting rights or citizenship rights, but have a little bit more mobility than the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And then we have another legal framework for the Palestinians in the West Bank, guided still under the Oslo Agreement, but is a bit of a fourth Geneva Convention, Israeli laws and Palestinian laws, but one which maintains Israel's sovereignty or control over the settlements, which and Area C, which still constitute 56% of the West Bank. And then we have another legal regime for Gaza, in which Israel has retreated from Gaza physically, but is still in control of the borders of Gaza, the sea, access to sea, and the air, the biggest prison in in the world today, in which Palestinians in Gaza are under prison and under siege. So this reality that we live in, a reality on which Israel is the only sovereign, Israel has instituted an apartheid system based on eliminating the Palestinian question by fragmenting it, eliminating Palestinian existence, because every colonial project is based on elimination. In the case of Israel and Palestine, Israel tried to eliminate the Palestinian political existence by fragmenting them into various entities. So this makes the case, how do we go from a colonial reality to a decolonial reality? How do we decolonize, as Jeff nicely put it? And I think decolonization can only happen through a one democratic state, because such a state guarantees equal rights for all. It does not distinguish between race or nationality or language. The one state solution is the only option that will translate the reality of apartheid into a reality of equality, one that would foster economic development rather than rely on the exploitation of Arabs by Israel. It's also one that demographically is only viable, because today in this land that that Israel is sovereign, and in which it controls the Palestinian population, we have a total population of 6.8 million Jews and 6.8 million Palestinians. The fact that 50% of the population under Israel's control is Palestinian and growing faster than the Israeli poses a major question, both for Israel's identity as a Jewish state, but above all, emphasizing the reality of inequality that we have, an inequality which is racial, economic, and political, and which will not be sustainable. And last but not least, I think the biggest argument for the one-state solution and democratic state is the fact is that it is the most viable and realistically possible and morally superior to any other solution. It's the only one that will reverse the reality of apartheid into a reality of equality. This doesn't mean that it is easy, but it does mean that it is the only option if you want to allow Jews and Palestinian refugees and immigrants to live in Palestine, Israel, equally. I'll stop on that and I will take it from here. Thank you.
Thank you both for your opening comments. I want to get into the nitty-gritty of the 10-point plan, but the one question I keep hearing over and over again when people hear one democratic state is what, and Jeff, I'm going to ask you to address Israel, and Layla, I'm going to ask you to address the Palestinians, but why would Israel, the dominant power in this relationship, why would they want to buy into one state? And Layla, there's disagreement among Palestinians. One state means a radical rethinking of national identity. I mean, Palestinian friends of mine, some of them are still holding on to a possibility of two state because of national aspirations. So why would Palestinians agree to one state? So, I mean, that's the question I hear again and again and again. So each one of you, would you take a crack at that?
All right. Well, that's a good question, because it's true. There's issues on both sides. In terms of Israeli Jews, they're not going to buy into this. I mean, I don't want to, you know, present any kind of an illusion that somehow we're going to convince Israeli Jews that apartheid is bad and Absolutely. We should decolonize. That's not going to happen.
Right.
And it's very much in my view, similar to South Africa. You know, because in South Africa, you had the same situation. And that is, you had a dominant population, the white European population in South Africa, that ran the country, that was not going to cooperate with the ANC in terms of dismantling apartheid. You had a government that was an apartheid government that was not going to cooperate. You had an international community of governments that saw Mandela and the ANC as terrorists. They weren't going to cooperate either. So the ANC or the black population, the anti-apartheid population in South Africa, that was very small, especially, you know, towards the beginning, had only one ally de facto, and that was the international civil society, the people. I mean, all of you. You know, they and people of a certain age, remember, we were all involved in the anti-apartheid struggle. And we succeeded, you know, all of us together in terms of making apartheid unsustainable, partly by changing our government's policies abroad. So that I think is very similar to what the Palestinians have to do. They have to understand, and they do understand, that the Israeli Jews are not going to be active partners. I mean, we're not going to run around trying to convince I'm not going to convince my neighbors that I love that there should be one state. That's just a non-starter. It's not going to happen. Now, there will be some Israeli Jews, obviously, like me, and there's others critical that will be a part of it. And that's important because I think we give credibility. And I think in terms of the program that we're offering, that we'll talk about in a couple minutes, I think it's very powerful because Israelis were involved with Palestinians in formulating it. So it isn't that the Palestinian group got together in some kind of a vacuum and put up a plan and didn't care whether Israelis liked it or not, or if it was just or not, or whatever, just what they... No, we really had 2 years of really intense discussions where our job as Israeli Jews was to bring in what we thought were critical issues that the Israeli Jews had to have on the table as well. So I think that was a very important part of the thing. But we understand that the Israeli Jews are not going to be partners, and therefore, I think our strategy is going to have to be to appeal to all of you, to the international civil society, churches, labor unions, university groups, students, human rights organizations, you know, political groups, in order to support the Palestinian claims. And but one more sentence. I can tell Michael. That is, you see, what the ANC did, though, in its mobilization of the international community, was it always had an end game.
Yeah,
you know, one person, one vote. So everybody knew why we're boycotting South Africa. When de Klerk came to talk to Mandela, Mandela could say yes or no to his offers based on the end game the ANC had in mind. One person, one vote. We don't have that today. That's what we're trying to insert, because the two-state solution is gone. That was the plan that the PLO bought into. Right or wrong, but that's gone. And the one state idea we're just beginning to articulate now. So there's in a way a political vacuum, but we're not going to be able to mobilize civil society for this cause if we don't present a clear and compelling political plan.
You know, I've known you for 15 years, Jeff, and from the first time I met you, you've been talking about the necessity of a political strategy, an end game. And so, this once Democratic state campaign is the fruition of that desire and hope. Yeah, Layla, please.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. So I totally agree with Jeff. We've been trying to think of what would be the political strategy for a one-state solution. The one state is not a new idea. It's a very old idea. It's an idea that was Zionist had it, human Zionist, what we call human Zionist, people like Martin Buber and Yehuda Magnus. But it was put aside. It was the idea of a binational state. Then the Palestinian came up with the one state idea, which is a democratic state. Democratic state in all of Palestine, inclusive of Jews, Muslims, and Christians. This was the platform of the PLO from 1971 until 1988. The reason why the Palestinian gave up the idea of a one state and opted for the idea of a two-state solution is because the international consensus unlike South Africa, was on the solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or the is a two-state solution. So the Palestinian opted for the state, largely because on half of Palestine, on part of Palestine, on 22% of Palestine, arguing that the idea of a state is better than no state, because a state can give you some rights, can give you a passport, can give you some borders, will give you institutions, will allow some return. The big problem was, as Jeff said, given that Zionism is a colonial project, Israel was not interested in implementing a two-state solution. So I think what happened to the Palestinian National Movement is that we tried the two-state solution and Israel made it fail. Israel, as if was saying, Zionism, as if was saying, it cannot even accept Palestinians' capitulation. Zionism can only accept Palestinians' absence, elimination. Well, the Palestinians are not going anywhere. So what's happening with the Palestinian National Movement right now is trying to figure out, can we afford to give up a Palestinian state? Can we exist without having a Palestinian state? And I think what happened is now everybody is aware, okay, everybody recognizes the Palestinians. This was not the case 40 years ago. 40 years ago, the Palestinians were just still a bunch of terrorists. Today, everybody knows who are the Palestinians. They know they have a claim to their land. They know they've been kicked out of their land. And they know that they have a right to equality and independence. The question, given that the two-state solution was tried and failed because it was never meant, how do we campaign for a one-state? And the Palestinians are divided in two lines. One that argues, precisely as Jeff said, no Israeli would ever accept a one-state solution. So why do we want to capitulate to the Israelis? The international system with UN Resolution 181 and 242 is based on the two-state solution. So it's stupid to give up the Palestinian state. If you give up the Palestinian state, so what do we become? So they say there is a legal framework. There is an international consensus that finally says, since Bush's 2003 roadmap, that a Palestinian state is a right and a necessity. This Palestinian state is recognized by 124 states in the United Nations. So many people say, this exists. You want to throw it? You're going to throw the baby in the bathtub, as you say? They're arguing, no, you need to work with this recognition rather than eliminate it. Okay? And people are figuring out this. How do you work out this recognition of the fact that the Palestinians have a right to self-determination? This is why I think why Sam Bahour and others came up with the idea of a confederation, because the idea of confederation works with what you have on the ground. You have the recognition of a Palestinian state and an Israeli state, and you make them work together. But this is not going to work if you don't fundamentally address the economic and political and racial inequality that are foundational to Zionism. So how do you translate? Now, other people are saying, forget all that. We need to go to the drawing board and start, as Jeff said, the only solution is a one-state solution where everybody who lives on the land has a right to the land as equal, where you have to deal with a transitional justice issues and past injustices, so the right of return has to be guaranteed. But of course, it still remains difficult because, you know, the Palestinians have to take a stand on settlements. The Palestinians have to explain what you do with Jews who want to migrate to Palestine in a new state. So actually, it is much easier to talk about a two-state solution or binational state than actually start saying, what are the rights of the Jews in Palestine? What are the rights of migrants? When, you know, how do we get Israelis to recognize the right of returns? Or we don't give a damn about Israel recognizing the right of return, because this is about power. So the question, how do you generate an international support that ensures that international law is implemented, which means the right of return, equal rights, one vote, one person, one vote, as Jeff said. This needs a reliance on international law, international reliance on international support, but also work on the ground, which is difficult to do when you are so much imprisoned. This is why I think the Palestinians who are best placed to talk about the one state and taking the lead in talking about state are the Palestinians in the diaspora and the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. And in my view, it's the Palestinian citizens of Israel that can lead the conversation because they are the bridge between the two camps.
Thank you, Leila and Jeff. So you both have mentioned now the right of return. So I want to talk about that. One, it's absolutely critical in the plan, in the one democratic state, the right of return for Palestinian refugees and their descendants, it says in the plan. It's listed near the very top. In fact, you call it in the 10-point plan, right of return, restoration, and reintegration into society. Yet it seems intractable in practical reality. At least that's the popular characterization of the right of return. So, Leila, would you start us off this time talking about the right of return and why that's so critically necessary and how you see it playing out in real life? And then Jeff, you pick it up after Leila.
The right of return is central to the conflict because it's the essence of the conflict. It's the refugees. Israel has justified its creation on the fact that it was in gathering the refugees of the Holocaust. Okay, but it expelled the original people, which are the Palestinians, creating the biggest refugee problem. And we have UN Resolution 194 that emphasizes the right of every person, every refugee to return, to restitution, and to compensation. It is foundational to the question of equality because Israel's creation was based on the expulsion of the Palestinians. Okay? A nation state based on expulsion it succeeded in the past, but you carry still the ghosts of the injustices. The refugee problem is still alive because there are much more legal measures that support it. And also because it's foundational to the question of the equality and the rights of everybody who came from that land to live in that land.
Thank you. Jeff?
Well, again, there's a logic to our plan. And the logic comes out of, and Leila touched on this before, what's really revolutionary in this idea is that you're changing the basis of the country from being based on an ethnic, national, religious, basis or differences to one that's based on universal citizenship. So in Israel, Palestine today, who you are, what your civil rights are, who you can marry, what job you have, where you can live, whether you can even leave the country or not, all depends on who you are in terms of your ethnic or national or religious identity. And that's, of course, the basis of not only the elimination of the indigenous, but also of the apartheid system that we put into place. So you have to just get rid of all that. That part of a big part of decolonization is dismantling all these structures of domination and control and separation. Now, refugees have a right to return. We argue that. But in the logic of our plan, in the logic of citizenship, there's a whole other set of rights that they have laid on top of that. And that is that the refugees are our citizens. In other words, the fact that you're driven out of the country during a war, or you flee a country during a war, does not mean you lose your civil rights. You know, you become a refugee, that's true. But it doesn't mean you've lost your rights to be in your country. So that the idea of citizenship says, not only do the Palestinian refugees have a right to return, but we want them to return because they're our citizens, they're our people. We want them to come home to our. So you see, there's that. It goes beyond simply an argument or a legal case to the fundamental right of a citizen to live in his or her country. Now, in terms of the practical thing that you mentioned, actually, if you get into it, it's very practical. The possibility of the refugees actually returning. There's a well-known Palestinian geographer named Salman Abu Sita, who's done a lot of work on land issues and refugee issues in Palestine. And he's found that 85% of the land taken from the Palestinians in 1948 is still available. It's either agricultural land, it was grabbed by the kibbutzim or the moshavim when the Palestinians left, but they kept the agricultural lands. They destroyed the villages and the towns, but they kept the lands as agricultural lands. Or they're under national parks, or they're parts of beaches or whatever. But in other words, the land was not built upon, 85% of it. So it's true, as a refugee, you're not going to come back to your own home. Your own home is probably gone, unless, you know, there's still a few in urban areas. But basically, Israel demolished more than 530 villages and towns and urban areas. So your house is probably gone. But you can come back to the part of the country where you come from. Now, there's another thing. There's an organization here called Zuchrot, an Israeli organization. And they have a really interesting program with young Palestinian architects and planners. And you can look it up on their website. And they're planning out on this land modern communities. Because again, like you say, Michael, part of the plan isn't only to bring back the refugees, but to be sure that they're reintegrated. Don't forget, this is a traumatized population for the most part. A lot of them have lived under violence for generations. They're traumatized. They're underemployed. They're undereducated, many of them. And so, you know, there has to be, they can't just come back and become an underclass in the society. We have to reintegrate them. So there's all kinds of plans of building modern communities on the lands, you know, that they'll come back to, so that they're able to come back to functioning places, modern accommodations with infrastructure and economy and with other populations. They're not going to be ghettos of refugees. So if you actually get into the nitty gritty, which is very exciting, I mean, the whole idea of building a new society is actually, you know, I don't see it as a threat to Israel. I see it as a challenge to all of us, including Israelis. You find out that actually it's not only just the return of the refugees, but it's very doable. And therefore, obviously it's an absolute part of our program. You can't have any kind of program of peace and reconciliation and justice without the refugee issue being addressed squarely.
Barbara Harvey, who's with Jewish Voice for Peace in the Detroit area, sent a question, and I want to have you address it briefly. She said to her mind, whether there's two states or even a single state with Palestinian Bantustans, she's wondering whether it could even physically survive in the long term, given what's been happening in Gaza, where the infrastructure, health facilities, schools, water purification plants, police stations, and others have been bombed. So it makes it physically impossible for a society to even survive. So even if the status quo remains, she's wondering whether it could even if there's a long-term survival possibilities. Do you want to address that very briefly, each one of you?
Yeah, I want to say just two things. Yeah, I'll address this point, but I also want to add something to the issue that Jeff mentioned about the right of return. Right of return is a right, but also don't forget that it's foundational because, as he said, it's the way by which you create an equal society, and they are citizens of the state. But also remember that the refugees, what they want is the recognition of the right of return.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, and I think this is very important, because you admitting your original sin is very important, because we don't know how many will return, but if they all want to return, there's place for them. But it's about admitting that this is a problem, which is, you know, this is the foundation of this, just like the United States, the foundation of the United States is sinful, is based on the elimination of the natives. Okay, we have the privilege, we can talk about that, because there are not so many natives as there are not Palestinians in Israel.
Often when I answer this question, Layla, it's not just return, but it's having the right of return. And I think that's what you're
exactly. The right of return and recognition of right. The right of return.
Yeah.
How you exercise the right of return is another thing. But getting Israel, for Israel is major. This is why it touches its foundations. And for Israel to recognize the right of return is admitting that Zionist existence is based on a sinful creation. So how do you deal with that? That's on the Israelis. So that's not on me. Now, coming to the question of the survival of Gaza Strip or not. And of course, the Gaza Strip is not... You know, a place people predict that in 20 years' time, the water is in 10 years' time, 5 years' time, the water will be unportable. You cannot read it, you cannot take it, you cannot drink it. So, but human nature has been incredibly resilient and finding a way to live in very hard circumstances. So, the question is not this, the question is not what's happening in Gaza is unacceptable and has been going on for the past 12 years. If you would have asked us 15 years ago, would that have been possible that you put 2 million people under this siege? We would have said, it's out of your mind. So it is unfathomable, it's not acceptable, but it is continuing because of the Israel has immunity. So the only way how to make this the daily life more bearable is to hold Israel accountable, to boycott Israel, to hold it to international law, to equal standards like everybody else, and to uphold international law. That's what I want to say. But the question then becomes, how do you hold Israel accountable when Israel has so much power? Israel has been the biggest success in vaccinating its population. It vaccinated the Palestinians inside 48. It vaccinated the Palestinians in Jerusalem. It has better vaccination policy than the United States, where Pfizer and Moderna produced a new vaccine. So Israel has incredible access to military and technological advances, is giving technology to the US and Asia. So a country as powerful as Israel, how on earth are you going to convince it to give up its power? Nobody gives its power willingly. They have to be challenged. And I think that's the fundamental question. And this means that we have to look at the problem also regionally and internationally. The role of what's going to happen to the Middle East. You will no longer be able to solve the problem of Palestine if you don't solve the problem of Syria and Egypt. You will no longer be able to solve the problem of the two-state solution and the apartheid if you don't address the new bonds being created between authoritarian regimes and colonial regimes. In other words, between the United Arab Emirates and Israel, or Saudi Arabia and Israel. Authoritarianism and colonialism go hand in hand. The democracy and authority and colonialism do not work. So I think, again, emphasizing that we are upholding democratic rights and equality for all is the best way to challenge Israel on its assumption and hold Israel accountable to an assumption and take away the power that Israel has by holding it accountable.
Thank you. Let me let's take another look at one of the other points in the 10-point plan. I think we understand the idea of individual rights, but in the 10-point plan, you also include the idea of collective rights. And I want you to talk a little bit about how those two are connected. How does this relate to one of your other points, constructing a shared civil society? So is this an incentive for the adoption of the one democratic state, or is it an obstacle, or simply a reality given the historical and political context? How are these three interrelated? Individual rights, collective rights, and a shared civil society.
Look, those are all parts of the process of decolonization. In other words, equal rights already changes the relationship between the colonizers and the colonized, and creates a common political space based on equality. Just to go back for a second to Barbara's question, because it relates into here too, and that is that the whole idea of individual rights obviously means a parity, we have to see the Palestinians as actually being in very strong position potentially. In other words, the Palestinians have one of the highest literacy rates in the world. They have very, an educated population. If you take all the Palestinians in the world and all the Israeli Jews in the world, there are more Palestinians in universities than there are Israeli Jews. So, they have a certain edge in that even. they've got a very strong economy, not only in agriculture, but in high tech. And in other areas, Sam is a part of that, the whole cyber economy and so on. And the Palestinians have another resource that people don't take into account, and that's the diaspora. They have a very large and very wealthy and very educated diaspora that would also kick in. So I would say, without being Pollyannish about it, it's true that Israel is very strong, but I think that Shir Hever, who's a political economist, an Israeli political economist, writes that there's a lot of complementariness between the Palestinian and Israeli economies. They function very well together if given a chance. And so I think within a generation, maybe less. I really think that given a level playing field, the Palestinians will not take a long time before they reach a certain parity with the Israeli Jewish population. So that I think we have to take that into account. We're not talking about South Africa, where colonialism left the black population completely uneducated, completely without skills, almost completely without political power or land or anything. The Palestinians really have resources. They're not able to use them today, but they're there. That would come out like a jack in the box if the lid was opened and they were able to achieve parity. That's the individual.
Jeff, you're muted right now. Jeff, unmute yourself, please.
Collective rights is that we understand we're not in Nebraska. That there are national groups. Palestinian Arabs, Israeli Jews, for better or for worse, are national groups. And there are other important groups here. There's different ethnic groups, there's different religious groups in the country. And so our idea also, of course, is we have to recognize, in addition to being a democracy with universal citizenship, that we're also a pluralistic, multicultural country. And we have to respect that as well. So in our plan, we say that you have your right to your collective identity. You can keep your identities, you can keep your institutions, you can keep your rituals and your holidays and all of that, within the framework of a democracy, which is very much like the United States and other countries, just simply a pluralistic democracy. But that's important because, as you said, Michael, in the very beginning, we can't ignore the fact that the Palestinians want their national identity. That's what they've been fighting for all these years. and Israeli Jews as well. They're not going to give up, you know, being Zionists, no matter what the political structures are. So you say, okay, we have to find ways for those things to be expressed, but not at the expense of living together and so on. And that leads me quickly to the third point, and that is this whole idea of a common civil society, a new civil society, a new political economy. And here's where I think this is the one of the end points of decolonization. That is, not only have you dismantled all the colonial structures and created a new polity and a new society where people can begin to integrate and live together in equality and so on, but you're also creating a new national, if you want to put it that way, a state-based identity. You know, like, for example, in Jordan. I mean, Jordan is an absolutely artificial country. It was created with a pencil by the British. But there is today a Jordanian identity in many, you know, it has developed over the course of years as people live together and participate in a common political and economic framework. So I think that's going to happen too. And a new political community will begin to emerge. And that's why we're not looking at a binational state, because there's two versions of the one state.
Right.
One of them is binational. So a lot of people, more people buy into the binational idea, which is obviously easier to sell to Israelis because, you know, Israeli somehow, you know, there's a way of then retaining this Israeli national thing. And it's sort of a form of the two-state solution in a way. Problem with the binational solution is, again, it perpetuates these borders, these ethnic, national, religious borders. So in our idea, we'll have one society, one political community emerging that everybody can agree on, can participate in, can be a part of. And then within that, if you want to marry within your religious community, or you want to live within your ethnic community, that's fine. You can do that. But nevertheless, a new nationwide political community has emerged. And that really is, I think, together with the acknowledgments that Leila was talking about, that really is the end game in terms of decolonization. When not only a new polity, but a new society and a new decolonized national identity, there's a new us that begins to emerge. And let me use one quick example that I've used before, just in a sentence, just to give a concrete example of that. You know, football is very important, not Super Bowl, but what you know, you call soccer is important in the world. And in the FIFA standings, the international football standings, the Palestinian football team has a higher ranking than the Israeli team. But neither have succeeded in getting into the World Cup. And the World Cup is like the Super Bowl on steroids. No? Can you imagine if the combined teams, actually there's a film called Goal Dreams that you might look at, the 2006 World Cup, where Palestine got very close to getting in, the Palestinian national team. But imagine if together our team, you know, gets into the World Cup, the kind of nation building that would generate. So I think what we have to do is provide that framework and those structures and that parity where all this can happen, and then let it happen. And I think personally in the younger generation, I think we're going to get to a kind of a normalization quicker than we expect. You know, the young generation moves on fairly quickly. And I think that's the optimistic part of our plan.
We have to leave it there. You have been listening to a conversation with Leila Farzak, a professor at University of Massachusetts, Boston, and Israeli activist and former professor Jeff Halper, discussing a way forward to a one democratic state in Palestine, Israel. That is our program this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم